My name is Jade Membry and my husband is Trent Membry. We've been pastoring a location for about 6 years. So to be in a location here, it feels like home. It feels fantastic. It's got that vibe that's just fantastic, you know. And I just wanted to share a word. Is it Nimi? Nimi was in the prayer meeting. Nimi was sharing a word from Isaiah. And God just prompted me to share a word that he gave to Trent and I. See, we were in a location like this. We were bumping in and out every week, and we were at this place of growing. You know, we were growing and we were sort of reshaping. And it was like, what's the next step? What are we doing next? And God just gave us this word, and he just said to me this morning, share it this morning. And it says here in Isaiah 54:2, and you probably all know it, but I believe it's a word in season for you. Enlarge the place of your tent. Stretch your tent curtains wide. Do not hold back. Lengthen your cords. Strengthen your stakes, for you will spread out to the left and to the right. Your descendants will dispossess nations and settle in their desolate cities. That is a word for you. You are going to spread to the left and the right. You are going to grow. Your descendants are going to dispossess nations and settle in desolate cities. You know, there are desolate places in New Zealand that need the touch of God, and you are the people to reach them. So I just felt to share that with you this morning. So my husband Trent, he's going to be sharing tonight. He's sort of the other part of the story. You know, like when I share my testimony, there's kind of chunks that I skip over because they're Trent's story. They're his testimony. They're not my story. So I really want to encourage you, come and hear the other half of the story tonight. Do be there. Fill the place. You know, it's going to be great, you know. So do come along. So Trent and I, we were pastoring youth to start with. We had an intermediate aged ministry, which was fantastic. I really think that that's a really crucial age group to be investing into. You know, 11, 12, 13-year-olds, they are the future. They're the people that are going to be taking you through church when you're, you know, old and in the next season. So we've got to invest into them. So they were a fantastic ministry to be a part of. And then we went on to our Manukau campus. So Manukau is a suburb in South Auckland. We had a real melting pot of cultures. I think every culture under the sun was in that church. And it was a real place of family and community and connection. It was just such a hearty place. And then about a year ago, we got moved into our main campus. So we got to sort of settle there for a little while we transitioned out to Whangarei. So we've just moved up to Whangarei about 2 weeks ago, and we're planning to, see the same impact as we saw in Manukau. We saw Manukau grow. It was, when we came in, it was 30 people in a mechanics warehouse. And God grew it to a thriving church of 300 people. You know, we went from this mechanics warehouse where we were bumping in and out every week to buying our own building. Now, this was in the, you know, Auckland's prices are going like this. Well, God's kingdom, no, doesn't believe that. We were in a building and it's been amazing and it's still growing. So that's a bit about Trent and I. We've got two little girls as well. We've got an 11-year-old and a 10-year-old, which you'll hear about in my story. But see, when I first came into church, I was a 22-year-old girl. I was pregnant. I had a toddler in tow. And it was within a matter of weeks that our senior pastor, you might know Pastor Chris Pringle, she came swirling into the place to preach. And she absolutely captivated my heart with the beautiful freedom that she had in God. You know, and the love that she expressed for Jesus and for his people. You know, I couldn't believe that this fun and pretty cheeky woman could actually be a Christian. I thought that Christians were these boring, dull, kind of beige people, you know, grey beige people. But with one fell swoop, she absolutely smashed through that stereotype and took me another step deeper into my love for Jesus Christ. But see, in order to be beginning a love affair with Jesus at the age of 22, I had to have been somewhere before that. And that's what I'm here to share with you today. You know, God gives us all a story, and we have got to share our stories. You know, our church is always focused on this theme of search and rescue, you know, this theme of going out and reaching the lost. And it is vital to our Christian walk that we be doing that. You know, that is Jesus's commission for us, to go out and seek the lost. You know, the word of God says that the harvest is ready, but the workers are few, and it is us. We need to be the workers. You know, I only came in because of the workers searching for me, people searching for me. I was totally at the end of myself. I was ripe for the picking. You know, I was so ready to be harvested. You know, and I thank God that my family were praying for me, that they were believing God for me. I'm so grateful that my current pastor was searching for me and had people out there looking to rescue me. See, I came from a well-off Christian family. I actually should have been okay, you know, by the way statistics go, I should have been okay. But see, my parents divorced when I was 3. They both remarried and they had a child each. Life was pretty good. I grew up living in some of the most beautiful suburbs of Auckland. I went to a very prestigious girls' school, and we attended one of the largest and most influential churches in our city during the late 80s and early 90s, until the church fell apart. And this fall displaced my family when I was about 12 years old, and we found ourselves in the wilderness years with no regular Christian fellowship. Our family believed in God. We believed that there was God. But the value on church, on community, and accountability had diminished. And this led to a complacent attitude towards God. He existed. We prayed, usually over dinner, and that was probably about it. You know, he was convenient. He fit into our lives rather than the other way around. And looking back, I noticed that without our pastors, without leaders, without friends, without fellow Christians sharpening us, my parents stopped going to their connect groups. They stopped going to Bible studies. They stopped going to prayer meetings. You know, the Bibles in our house were kind of used much like a dictionary. You know, they were sort of on the shelf, growing dusty, and they'd be brought out when you really, really needed it, kind of like Christmas time, you know, when Nana came over and you needed to, you know, we've got the Bible out, that kind of thing. You know, the concept of worship music being played in a home setting was just so foreign to me. And the idea of praying in your own time, you know, by yourself, not around a table when you're about to eat because it's etiquette, was just bizarre to me. You know, don't get me wrong. My parents were beautiful, caring people. You know, they had great hearts. They cared for others. They still spent time with their Christian friends. But who knows that we're called to more than that? You know, sadly, in my home, the habits that spur us on to press into the call to seek the lost were gone. And the zeal for God and the evidence of God being real to me were gone with him. Personally, this lack of zeal led me further and further and further away from God until he was just a distant notion that had absolutely no impact on my life or the course I chose to take. God to me was just a nice concept, but completely irrelevant to the real life, to the real world. And this mindset would have a radical impact on my life as I wrestled with the challenges of adolescence. So I never really understood who God was or where I belonged. I knew we prayed thanks to God. I knew we could ask for God's blessings, but I really thought that's where it ended. I didn't know I could have a personal relationship with God or that he actually loved me as a daughter, that I was actually adopted into sonship, into daughtership. You know, spiritually this meant that I was alone and actually orphaned. But you know what? We are not created to feel alone. That is not how we were created. We were created for a relationship with God. And through that relationship with God, our relationships with ourselves, the way we can view ourselves and love ourselves, is formed. You know, and that's how our relationships with others flow. So as a result of this disconnect with God, with other Christians, and an unhealthy attachment to the world, by the time I got to high school, I fell in with a pretty wild group of girls. You know, these were beautiful women, and they still are beautiful women, and some of them slowly, one by one, are coming to Christ. But you know, all of these women had this commonality of being a bit hurt, you know, just something in life had kind of thrown them. And we all had a tendency to seek comfort in the world, and we all had a tendency to really just take things too far. So it started with boys and booze. I was desperately seeking to be loved, to be wanted. But I was also a total introvert. And like many other teens, as it's still common today, I discovered that drinking was a very, very handy way to deal with this shyness problem. When I was under the influence of alcohol, I could actually command the attention and admiration of anybody that I wanted to. And the difference to when I was sober was so remarkable to me. And the rush I got from being wanted, and I say wanted because I wasn't really wanted, it was just in the moment, seemed so worth it. And so a nasty spiral of substance abuse began. I thought I was just a normal teen doing normal teenage things because of the groups that I was running in. But there was absolutely nothing normal about the things I was doing at the age I was at. In fact, there's just nothing normal about it at any age. You know, I was a highly functioning addict, and I had become so good at hiding who I was and what I was doing from my parents and any authorities. I was smart. I was strong. I could pull off great grades, and I had a perfect attitude in my home. And I loved my home, but I was more addicted to the challenge of being wanted by others outside of it. I remember when I was about 17, almost 17, I wasn't quite 17, and the ability to hide what I was becoming became less and less of a thing that I was even concerned about. I eventually decided that it would just be a whole lot easier to drop out of school early and move out of home. I could do exactly what I wanted, and it wouldn't be so tiring trying to live a double life. But you see, within a year, I was 17. I was boozing every single day. I was toxic. I was absolutely broke. You know, I was scraping the bottom of the barrel every single week. I was broken. I was being emotionally abused constantly by my partner. I was so utterly lost, and I was scared. I was really scared. But you know what? I also found out I was pregnant. And sadly, the boy that I'd been living with for that past 2 years was seeing other women constantly at the time, and we had emotionally checked out of our relationship. But in the state of worthlessness I was in, I hadn't been able to leave. I remember this man dropped me to an abortion clinic, and completely alone, I went in for the interview, for the subsequent procedure, and I was then picked up again, dropped at our flat while my partner and all of my flatmates went out to party. I didn't tell my parents about this for 12 years. In fact, I didn't tell anybody apart from my flatmates and a couple of friends. And I finally broke. I lost my way completely, and I turned into a very, very angry, very emotional, very dark woman. The relationship I was in finally ran its course, it had to, and defeated, I moved home and tried to rebuild myself. Now, God to me at this point was non-existent. My parents had, you know, strayed so far into the wilderness that the Bible wasn't even really on the shelf, growing dusty. I think it had been put in a box in the attic or something like that. You know, God was non-existent. And it wasn't that I didn't believe. God just never came to my mind, and nobody mentioned God to me. So I quickly busied myself by enrolling into tertiary education. I enrolled into a makeup school, but you see, trouble seems to have a way of finding itself, right? And I fell in with a group of very, very wealthy but very, very naughty girls, and I dropped out. By this time, I was 18, so I was legal to drink. And I fell in love with the city. I devoured the city. I became a bartender and a regular feature in the VIP nightclub rooms. You know, life became this absolute spinning whirlwind of sex, drugs, and rock and roll, or house music as it was. I was constantly numb or hungover or high. and my appetite for love now was insatiable, yet I could never quite pin it down. Eventually, I settled on what I thought was the next best thing, a boyfriend who simply adored having me on his arm. But he also happened to have hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of a drug called methamphetamine. I met him, I went to his house, and I never went home again. You know, I wasn't overly attracted to him. I certainly didn't love him. But I was so empty that this did not matter. You know, in this new life, I was perpetually strung out on drugs. But because we were dealing to New Zealand celebrities, musicians, business people, I'm talking doctors, surgeons, pilots, lawyers, I thought I was doing just fine. You know, we were rolling in cash. We didn't have any gang associations. We lived in a beautiful apartment. I thought I looked okay, but I was really probably death, just absolutely covered in makeup and designer clothes. You know, my friends and family were terrified for me. You know, they saw the reality of what was happening, and they knew that they had finally lost their grip on me. I pushed them away utterly and completely. I had nothing left of what I was, who I was inside of me, and I could successfully obliterate every single emotion, be it happy or sad, with a substance. You know, it was in this time of my life that my substance abuse was at its absolute worst. I was smoking an unlimited amount of meth each day. I'm talking morning till night, over and over again, staying up for days at a time. You know, I had probably a $500 a day meth habit, if not more. You know, to get to sleep, I would take a drug called GHB. It knocks you out. And then in the morning, I would use a drug called NOS just to wake me up enough to get back on that meth pipe. And then the cycle began again. I really ate. Even alcohol had become a completely powerless substance to me. It didn't have any effect on me. I smoked more than a packet of cigarettes a day, and my weight plummeted until I was a walking skeleton. I had this downy fur all over me that often happens when you become underweight. Normally women with and men with eating disorders, you know, they get this downy fur because the body's breaking down and it's trying to keep warm. You know, my hair was falling out. My hair was absolutely falling out in chunks, and my skin was breaking out all over my body. I was literally falling apart. Meanwhile, though, God was moving and God was working. You know, he was already seeking his lost child. See, my mother and father, through these circumstances, had been drawn back really closely to God. You know, they'd started attending a new church and they were desperately praying. And my dad and my stepmother, who always said they'd never believe in God, they found salvation for the first time. You know, both sides of my family had formed prayer chains, and my mother had implored her pastor to ask his youth to reach out to me. You know, there's a scripture in 1 Samuel 17, verse 34, where it's, you know, David is about to fight Goliath. And it says, "But David said to Saul, 'Your servant has been keeping his father's sheep. When a lion or a bear came and carried off a sheep from the flock, I went after it and struck it and rescued the sheep from its mouth.'" You know, that's where I was. I was in the mouth of the lion. I was about to be devoured. You know, but people were believing for me. People were fighting for me. People were going after me. You know, and I want to encourage you. Don't you ever stop believing for the people that you're praying for. You know, don't you ever stop reaching out to them. Send them those texts. Do not fear man. Do not fear what they're going to think of you when you send that text or when you make that call or when you invite them to that thing. You know, I want to encourage you in that. You know, if your pastors or your friends or your family members have asked you to reach out and connect to someone, do it. Do it, even if they seem so far gone. You know, they might be in the mouth of the lion, but you need to go and rescue them. Rescue them. You know, and when you've rescued them, then go slay that lion. You know, it goes on to say, "When it turned on me, I seized it by its hair, struck it and killed it. Your servant has killed both the lion and the bear. You know, kill that enemy. Make sure that those people are properly rescued. Kill them with your sword, with your word. You know, I remember getting these crazy text messages and voicemails from girls I'd known in my kids' church telling me, Jade, you're so loved. You know, asking me how I was, asking if I wanted to come to youth group. I mean, youth group, really? Or to church? Asking if I just wanted to hang out. And I remember thinking, what do these good girls know about real life or about my life or even about me or what I'm going through? Why would these nice people want to hang out with a wreck like me? You know, and I don't think I ever replied to those girls at the time, but I was really touched by those messages. You know, they were the first, they were like the foundation bricks in my path back to Jesus. You know, they left a really good impression of God and his people in my eyes. And I still know those girls. And I got to thank all of those girls, and there are some of them that I'm still in contact with today. You know, so it was still some time before I was set free, but the wheels were well and truly in motion. So after about a year into that relationship that I was in, my partner and I had successfully laundered $1.5 million worth of crystal meth. We would go halfway down the country every month or two and pick up 2 kilos worth of the drug, which would have arrived from labs in Japan. During this time, my partner made plans to take a trip to Brazil to dry out, but he still had a $200,000 deal that he needed to undertake. And he left me in charge of this under the supervision of one of his minders. This deal would take an entire week in multiple locations to complete. And part of the way through, I discovered via a Skype call that my partner had also taken his ex-girlfriend to Brazil with him. So I made a decision to leave him, but I knew that for my own safety, I had better finish that deal. And it was at this point in one of those locations that I met Trent Membry, my now husband, Trent. And we were instantly drawn to each other. It was like divine connection, I'm telling you. This was something supernatural. You know, and this attraction, it was enough to risk abandoning the deal that I was doing. It was enough to move out of that apartment, even though it was a scary thing to do, and move into a friend's house. It was enough to just give up that income. I mean, that was a great income that I've been enjoying, and the constant supply. I never had to pay for a drug that I'd been addicted to, and I began a relationship with this man. But see, the fallout from this decision to leave was immense. Unfortunately, although Trent was a good man, he was a sweet man, he was a kind man, still the man he is today, he was then. He was a good, good man, but he was tied up in the drug world too. But the thing is that his drug world was a tougher one. His one was tied up with gangs and protocols and loyalties, and the repercussions of our relationship rocked the drug and gang world in Auckland for a number of months. But we have an incredible and amazing, caring God. You know, and he was fighting for us. He was fighting for us even when we didn't know it. It's like you said, Ricardo, he was fighting us for us when we didn't even know it. And I believe that God was keeping us safe. It's like he had a cloak over us while he was smuggling us out of captivity. The scene we were moving in now was not one of glamour. It was not one of celebrity. It was tough, and it led to us being broke, living in his sister's lounge and still hooked on meth. And once again, I found out that I was pregnant. The difference this time was that there was absolutely no way that I was terminating this pregnancy, regardless of the unfavorable circumstances. And when I told Trent, he was completely supportive and surrounded me in love. You know, we had no idea what we were embarking on. I look back now and I just think, you crazy, crazy people. You know, we were less equipped than you could ever be. But I had begun to soften. I had managed to reunite with my family and my friends. And I began the very, very, very long and difficult journey to rebuild my life. I managed to get myself off drugs during my pregnancy. But I did it alone. Trent was still deeply entrenched in the drug world, and although I know he loved me, he did love me. But, you know, addiction is serious. And it wouldn't be until after our baby had been born that he would escape the debilitating grip of addiction. Before he did, though, we had moved into our own very, very tiny little one-bedroom unit. We'd furnished it with a few little scraps of donations from my family. And we tried our best to figure out how to look after this little baby that we now had. You know, we were really full of love for each other, for our baby. But despite this, I suffered some seriously extreme postnatal depression. And I silently endured a poverty that I had never experienced before. I was too embarrassed to tell anybody that could have helped. Trent was unraveling fast. He was using more drugs than he could sell, and we were living off a benefit, surviving on budget pasta and budget margarine each week. And I was just exhausted. I was exhausted trying to be a good mum on my own and trying to keep all of this under wraps. But you know what? We just didn't know how to escape what we knew. So about 3 months after Akayla was born, Trent was kidnapped. He got kidnapped for 3 days at gunpoint, and this is where you've got to come tonight because he's going to talk more about that. That's not my story to tell. But you know, I thought he'd just gone on another bender. And so I admitted what was going on to my mother. I went out and I admitted. I just went, I've had enough of this. I've had enough of his shenanigans. You see, Trent's kidnapping would be the pivotal moment where everything changed. Because while Trent was going through this ordeal, I had no idea what was happening. And I remember spending those days looking at my baby and reflecting on my childhood. And I thought about God for the first time. I thought about God. You know, I remembered the joy of those days where I went to church as a child. I remember the lunches after church, you know, those times of community. I remember those connections with beautiful Christian friends. And I actually liked those people, looking back. You know, I liked what those people carried. They were still my parents' friends, and I could still see what was happening in their lives, and I liked the fruit that they were bearing, and I wanted some of that fruit. You know, so tentatively, very tentatively, really not knowing what I was supposed to say, I began to pray. And you know, I got carried away in this prayer, and as I was praying, without even meaning to, I asked God if Trent was going to be the man that I was going to marry. And I was pretty blown away to hear a voice that was very different to my own. It was like a thought, like a voice, like undescribable, saying that I would marry a man from Christian City Church. I mean, what? What? This is like the first time I've prayed since I was a little girl. And that, what? You know, Christian City Church, I think that was my parents' church. That's probably why that church came into that prayer. But, you know, it was the most bizarre thing. And it really rocked me to hear this voice that I knew wasn't me. I knew I wouldn't think that up because, you know, my prayer would be, Lord, I want to manipulate you so that I can stay in this situation to stay with Trent because I don't want to leave because that's scary, you know? But it was different to that. And I believed that voice and I chose to move out because I knew that Trent Membry would never, ever go to church. So there I am praying and deciding to move in with a friend. There Trent is as a kidnapping victim and then returning home, broken from his ordeal, to find that me and Akayla had completely moved out the house. You know, we still had a couple of days left on the tenancy and my mother going back to check on a few things or drop off the keys, I don't know what she was doing, but she found him the next day curled up in the empty house in the fetal position. And she took him into her own house because I didn't want anything more to do with him to begin the journey of recovery. At this point, I stopped using the other substances I was holding on to, you know, a bit of alcohol here and there, and I still smoked. Trent entered rehab, and I concentrated on learning how to be a mother. Once he went to rehab, I moved into my parents' house, and I saw a doctor about my depression. Now, the doctor gave me medication because that's really all doctors can do. But I began to heal, and I hungered for the things that would enrich me and my daughter's lives. I knew I wanted to explore Christianity. And my mum, because mums are very, very clever, right? Mums are very clever. Who's a mum in the house here? Yeah, clever mums. But mum had planted a youth Bible beside my bed. And I thumbed through that youth Bible. I didn't really understand it at all. But I enjoyed the process and the comfort that it seemed to bring me. See, God was relentless and totally outrageous in his pursuit. You know, God knows us. He knows how to pursue us. You know, he was wooing me in with his love. And when Trent came out of rehab, I had clearly disregarded my prayer, and we reunited and we began our lives afresh. But I hadn't disregarded the fact that I was hungry to seek God. And my mom and I managed to get Trent because, as I said, he would never, ever go to church. But he did go to NA meetings. So we convinced him to come along to a recovery church, a Salvation Army recovery church. It was like the happy medium between a church service and an NA meeting. He's going, yeah, I'll just hang out with some of the bros at the back. It'll be fine. Also, at this service, they advertised an alpha course. Now, it was my birthday, and Trent was broke, so Trent ended up coming to an alpha course for my birthday. And at this alpha course, he radically discovered Jesus and the Holy Spirit for himself. So cool. So the next week we attended Christian City Church. That was the church that my parents had been going to. And we straight away gave our lives. We got on that altar, man. We did not waste any time. We didn't sit there and think about it. We were straight up the front. And within a week, we were baptized. You know, the battle for our lives had been won. And the hooks that the enemy had tried to ensnare us with were out. They were out. You know, we were in total and complete freedom. Hallelujah. And so began the most nourishing and restoring and wonderful journey. You know, we made it to the altar to be married. See, I did marry a man from Christian City Church. How crazy is our God? How awesome is our God? You know, we began, we had another little girl, and we began a journey into leadership in the church. And I was actually even healed from my depression. You know, I'd been prescribed Prozac from the doctor, and if I even went one day skipping that pill, I was a nightmare. I was a crazy woman the next day. But in a church meeting, when Pastor Phil was preaching, God told me, throw out your medication. And I believed him. I so believed him. I knew that voice, and that voice is right. And that was that. Over. Done. I have never experienced a day of depression in my life since. Now, that was about 7 years ago. You know, today, Trent and I, we carry a message of hope. And God has used us to restore thousands of people to him. We have seen thousands of people saved in our own world, in our own friends and family. We've seen over 70 friends and family saved. You know, we haven't smashed any of them over the head with the gospel. We've just lived it out. We've just been a living testimony of God's grace and goodness, you know, of his transformative power. You know, and this God that transformed my life, this God is the same God who is fighting for you, who's fighting for your issues, who's fighting for your prayers, and who's fighting for your family members. You know, he's fighting for the ones that don't know him. He's fighting for the ones that used to be sitting in these seats and who have walked away. You know, I want to encourage you as a church, as a whole church, as a body, and as individuals, don't give up. Don't grow weary. Don't give up on yourself. Don't give up on those people that you're believing for. Get them out of the mouth of the lion. You know, they might be going through something like addiction. You might be going through something like addiction. There's no shame in that. You know, it might be something much more sinister that you're going through. Or it may be something that is nowhere near as bad and you think, oh, it's not worth talking about. But you know what? It's all the same to God. You know, separation is separation, and he wants his lost ones back. You know, he wants his ones that are in church but living in shame and guilt set free. He wants his tired children recharged and burning for the commission, burning to help the lost come home, burning to build his church. He wants his apathetic children reignited. He wants each and every one of us living in the freedom of his love and of his grace. And I feel, you know, as I was getting ready to come and share this with you, I feel like God wants his church to know his mercy. You know, there is freedom in that. You are not bound up by religion. You are not bound up by rules. We are past that. We are so far past that. You know, he wants you to know his mercy for your past, for your present, and for your future. For the thoughts that you've had in secret. You know, for the mistakes that you've made that you haven't been able to tell anybody about, or that maybe you have told people about, but they've still got you bound up. You know, we're his kids, and kids make messes. You know, my kids make messes, but I don't leave them with their mess. You know, I'm not like, oh, look at that big mistake you made. You know, you've got grazes all up and down your legs. I'm off to the supermarket. See ya. You know, it's not like that. No, it's, darling, let me help you sort that out. Let me clean you up. Let me get you ready. Let me get you redressed in these beautiful, you know, he redresses us. He puts new robes on us. And then he takes us and says, come with us. Come with me.